her study of the newspapers. "He's not a tort reformer," Skip said, "though not without some doubt. He doesn't fit their mold. He's got too much baggage for a hard campaign. There's at least one DUI, at least two divorces." "I think I agree, but if he's never been involved before, then why is he suddenly screaming about the death penalty? Where does this conviction come from, this passion? Plus, his show yesterday was well organized. He's got people. Where do they come from?" "Do we really care? Sheila McCarthy beats him 2-1. We should be thrilled he is what he is, a buffoon, who we think is not being financed by the Commerce Council and all the corporate boys. Why aren't we happy?"
"Because we're trial lawyers."
Skip turned gloomy again.
"Should we arrange a meeting with Judge McCarthy?"
Barbara asked after a long, heavy pause. "In a couple of days. Let the dust settle." Judge McCarthy was up early, and why not? She certainly couldn't sleep. At 7:30, she was seen leaving her condo. She was trailed to the Belhaven section of Jackson, an older neighborhood. She parked in the driveway of the Honorable Justice James Henry McIlwain. Tony was hardly surprised by this little get-together. Mrs. McIlwain greeted her warmly and invited her inside, through the den and kitchen and all the way back to his study. Jimmy, as he was known to his friends, was just finishing the morning papers. McIlwain and McCarthy, Big Mac and Little Mac, as they were sometimes referred to. They spent a few minutes chatting about Mr. Coley and his astounding press coverage, then got down to business.
"Last night, I went through my campaign files," McIlwain said as he handed over a folder an inch thick. "The first section is a list of contributors, beginning with the heavy hitters and going south. All the big checks were written by trial lawyers."
The next section summarized his campaign's expenses, numbers that Sheila found hard to believe. After that, there were reports from consultants, sample ads, poll results, a dozen other campaign-related reports.
"This brings back bad memories," he said.
"Sorry, this is not what I wanted, believe me."
"You have my sympathy."
"Who's behind this guy?"
"I thought about it all night. He could be a decoy. He's definitely a nut. Whatever he is, you can't take him lightly. If he's your only opponent, sooner or later, the bad guys will find their way into his camp. They'll bring their money, and this guy with a fat checkbook could really be frightening."
McIlwain had once been a state senator, then an elected chancery court judge. He had fought the political wars. 2 years earlier, Sheila watched helplessly as he was savaged and abused in a bitter campaign. At its lowest point, when his opponent's television ads, later known to be financed by the American Rifle Association, accused him of being in favor of gun control, there is no greater sin in Mississippi. She had told herself that she would never, under any circumstances, allow herself to be so degraded. It wasn't worth it. She would scamper back to Biloxi, open a little boutique firm, and see her grandchildren every other day. Someone else could have the job. Now she wasn't so sure. She was angered by Coley's attacks. Her blood was not yet boiling, but it wouldn't take much more. At 51, she was too young to quit and too old to start over. They talked politics for over an hour. McIlwain spun yarns of old elections and colorful politicians, and Sheila gently nudged him back to the battles she now faced. His campaign had been expertly run by a young lawyer who took a leave of absence from a large Jackson firm. McIlwain promised to call him later in the day and check his pulse. He promised to call the big donors and the local operatives. He knew the editors of the newspapers. He would do whatever he could to protect her seat on the bench. Sheila left at 9:14, drove nonstop to the Garten building, and parked. The Coley announcement was noted at Peyton & Peyton, but little was said. On April 18th, the day after, three important events occurred, and the firm had no interest in other news. The first event was well received. The others were not. The good news was that a young lawyer from the tiny town of Bogachira stopped by and cut a deal with Wes. The lawyer, an office practitioner with no personal injury experience, had somehow managed to become the attorney for the survivors of a pulpwood cutter who had been killed in a horrible accident on Interstate 55 near the Louisiana line. According to the Highway Patrol, the accident had been caused by the recklessness of the driver of an 18-wheeler owned by a large company. An eyewitness was already on record, stating that the truck passed her in a wild rush, and she was doing around 70 miles per hour. The lawyer had a contingency agreement that would give him 30% of any recovery. He and Wes agreed to equally split it. The pulpwood cutter was 36 years old and earned about $40,000 a year. The math was easy. A $1 million settlement was quite possible. Wes drew up a lawsuit in less than an hour and was ready to file. The case was especially gratifying because the young lawyer chose the Peyton firm on account of its recent reputation. The Baker verdict had finally attracted a worthwhile client. The depressing news was the arrival of Crane's appellant brief. It was 102 pages long, twice the limit, and gave every impression of being beautifully researched and written by an entire team of very bright lawyers. It was too long and 2 months late, but the concessions had been granted by the court. Jared Curtin and his men had been very persuasive in their arguments for more time and more pages. It was obviously not a routine case. Mary Grace would have 60 days to respond. After the brief was gawked at by the rest of the firm, she hauled it to her desk for the first reading. Crane was claiming a grand total of 24 errors at trial, each worthy of correction on appeal. It began pleasantly enough with an exhaustive review of all the comments and rulings by Judge Harrison that allegedly revealed his intense bias against the defendant. Then it challenged the selection of the jury. It attacked the experts called on behalf of Jeanette Baker, the toxicologist who testified as to the near-record levels of BCL and Cardiolics and Achlar in Bowmore's drinking water. The pathologist who described the highly carcinogenic nature of these chemicals. The medical researcher who described the record rate of cancer in and around Bowmore. The geologist who tracked the toxic waste through the ground and into the aquifer under the town's well. The driller who drilled the test holes. The doctors who performed the autopsies on both Chad and Pete Baker. The scientist who studied pesticides and said ghastly things about Pillamar 5. And the most crucial expert, the medical researcher who linked BCL and Cardiolics to the cancerous cells found in the bodies. The Peytons had used 14 expert witnesses, and each was criticized at length and declared unqualified. Three were described as charlatans. Judge Harrison was wrong time and again for allowing them to testify. Their reports entered into evidence after lengthy fights were picked apart, condemned in scholarly language, and labeled as junk science. The verdict itself was against the overwhelming weight of the evidence and a clear indication of undue sympathy on the part of the jury. Harsh but skillful words were used to attack the punitive element. The plaintiff fell far short in her efforts to prove that Crane had contaminated the drinking water either by gross negligence or by outright intent. Finally, the brief ended with a strident plea for a reversal and a new trial, or better yet, an outright dismissal by the Supreme Court. This outrageous and unjustified verdict should be reversed and rendered, it read in closing. In other words, throw it out forever. The brief was well written, well reasoned, and persuasive, and after 2 hours of nonstop reading, Mary Grace finished it with a splitting headache. She took three Advil then gave it to Sherman, who eyed it with all the caution he would have given a rattlesnake. The third event, and the most alarming news, came in a phone call from Pastor Denny Ott. West took it after dark, then walked to his wife's office and closed the door. "That was Denny," he said. As Mary Grace looked at her husband's face, her first thought was that another client had passed away. There had been so many sad phone calls from Beaumore that she could almost anticipate one. "What is it?" He talked to the sheriff. "Mr. Leon Gatewood is missing." Though they had no affection whatsoever for the man, the news was still troubling. Gatewood was an industrial engineer who had worked at the crane plant in Beaumore for 34 years, a company man to the core. He had retired when Crane fled to Mexico and had admitted in deposition and on cross-examination at trial that the company had given him a termination package worth 3 years' salary, or about $190,000. Crane was not known for such generosity. The Paytons had found no other employee with such a sweet deal. Gatewood had retired to a little sheep farm in the southwest corner of Cary County, about as far from Beaumore and its water as one could possibly get and still reside in the county. During his 3-day deposition, he steadfastly denied any dumping at the plant. At trial, with a stack of documents, Wes had grilled him without mercy. Gatewood called the other crane employees liars. He refused to believe records that showed tons of toxic byproducts had, in fact, not been hauled away from the plant, but had simply gone missing. He laughed at the incriminating photographs of some of the 600 decomposed BCL drums dug up from the ravine behind the plant. "You doctored those," he shot back at Wes. His testimony was so blatantly fabricated that Judge Harrison talked openly in chambers of perjury charges. Gatewood was arrogant, belligerent, and short-tempered, and made the jury despise Crane Chemical. He was a powerful witness for the plaintiff, though he testified only after being dragged to court by a subpoena. Jared Curtin could have choked him. "When did this happen?" she asked. "He went fishing alone 2 days ago. His wife is still waiting." The disappearance of Earl Crouch in Texas 2 years earlier was still an unsolved mystery. Crouch had been Gatewood's boss. Both had vehemently defended Crane and denied what had become obvious. Both had complained of harassment, even death threats, and they weren't alone. Many of the people who worked there, who made the pesticides and dumped the poisons, had been threatened. Most had drifted away from Beaumore to escape the drinking water, to look for other jobs, and to avoid getting sucked into the coming storm of litigation. At least 4 had died of cancer. Others had testified and told the truth. Others, including Crouch, Gatewood, and Buck Burleson, had testified and lied. Each group hated the other, and collectively, they were hated by the remainder of Cary County. "I guess the stones are at it again," Wes said. "You don't know that." "No one will ever know. I'm just happy they're our clients." "Our clients are restless down there," she said. "It's time for a meeting." "It's time for dinner." "Who's cooking?"
"Ramona."
"Tortillas or enchiladas?"
"Spaghetti."
"Let's go find a bar and have a drink, just the two of us. We need to celebrate, dear. This little case from Bogachetta might just be a quick $1 million settlement."
"I'll drink to that."
Chapter 19. After 10 performances, Coley's Faces of the Dead tour came to an end. It ran out of gas in Pascagoula, the last of the big towns in the Southern District. Though he tried desperately along the way, Cleet was unable to get himself arrested again. He did, however, manage to generate quite a buzz at every stop. The reporters loved him. Admirers grabbed his brochures and began writing checks, albeit small ones. The local cops watched his announcements with silent approval. But after 10 days, Cleet needed a break. He returned to Natchez and was soon at the Lucky Jack, taking cards from Ivan. He had no real campaign strategy, no plan. He'd left nothing behind in the places he stopped, except for some fleeting publicity. There was no organization, except for a few volunteers, that he would soon ignore. Frankly, he wasn't about to spend the time or the money necessary to rev up a campaign of respectable size. He wasn't about to touch the cash Marlin had given him, not for campaign expenses anyway. He would spend whatever contributions trickled in, but he had no plans to lose money on this adventure. The attention was addictive, and he would show up when necessary to make a speech, attack his opponent, and attack liberal judges of all stripes. But his priority was gambling and drinking. Cleet had no dreams of winning. Hell, he wouldn't take the job if they handed it to him. He had always hated those thick law books. Tony Zachary flew to Boca Raton and was picked up by a chauffeur-driven car. He had been to Mr. Reinhardt's office once before and looked forward to the return. They would spend most of the next 2 days together. Over a splendid lunch with a beautiful view of the ocean, they had a great time reviewing the antics of their stooge, Cleet Coley. Barry Reinhardt had read every press clipping and seen every TV news report. They were quite pleased with their decoy. Next, they analyzed the results of their first major poll. It covered 500 registered voters in the 27 counties of the Southern District and had been conducted the day after Coley's tour ended. Not surprisingly, at least to Barry Reinhardt, 66% could not name any of the three Supreme Court judges from the Southern District. 69% were unaware that the voters actually elected the members of the Supreme Court. And this is a state where they elect the highway commissioners, public service commissioners, the state treasurer, state commissioners of insurance and agriculture, county tax collectors, county coroners, everybody but the dog catcher, Barry said. They vote every year, Tony said, peering over his reading glasses. He had stopped eating and was looking at some graphs. Every single year, whether it's municipal, judicial, state, and local or federal, they go to the polls every year. Such a waste. Small wonder turnout is low. Hell, the voters are sick of politics. Of the 34% who could name a Supreme Court justice, only half mentioned Sheila McCarthy. If the election were held today, 18% would vote for her, 15% would vote for Cleet Coley, and the rest either were undecided or simply wouldn't vote because they didn't know anyone in the race. After some initial straightforward questions, the poll began to reveal its slant. Would you vote for a Supreme Court candidate who is opposed to the death penalty? 73% said they would not. Would you vote for a candidate who supports the legal marriage of two homosexuals? 86% said no. Would you vote for a candidate who is in favor of tougher gun control laws? 85% said no. Do you own at least one gun? 96% said yes. The questions had multiple parts and follow-ups and were obviously designed to walk the voter down a path lined with hot-button issues. No effort was made to explain that the Supreme Court was not a legislative body. It did not have the responsibility or jurisdiction to make laws dealing with these issues. No effort was made to keep the field level. Like many polls, Reinhardt's skillfully shifted into a subtle attack. Would you support a liberal candidate for the Supreme Court? 70% would not. Are you aware that Justice Sheila McCarthy is considered the most liberal member of the Mississippi Supreme Court? 84% said no. If she is the most liberal member of the court, will you vote for her? 65% said no. But most of those being polled didn't like the question, if. Was she or wasn't she the most liberal? Anyway, Barry considered the question useless. The promising part was how little name recognition Sheila McCarthy had after 9 years on the bench, though in his experience, this was not unusual. He could argue with anyone privately that this was another perfect reason why state Supreme Court judges shouldn't be elected in the first place. They should not be politicians. Their names should not be well known. The poll then shifted away from the Supreme Court and settled onto the individual participants. There were questions about religious faith, belief in God, church attendance, financial support of the church, and so on. And there were questions about certain issues. Where do you stand on abortion, stem cell research, etc.? The poll wrapped up with the basics: race, marital status, number of children, if any, approximate income status, and voting history. The overall results confirmed what Barry suspected. The voters were conservative, middle class, and white, 78%, and could easily be turned against a liberal judge. The trick, of course, was to convert Sheila McCarthy from the sensible moderate she was into the raging liberal they needed her to be. Barry's researchers were analyzing every word she had ever written in a legal ruling, both at the circuit court level and on the Supreme Court. She could not escape her words. No judge could ever do that. And Barry planned to hang her with her own words. After lunch, they moved to the conference table, where Barry had a display of the initial mock-ups of Ron Fisk's campaign literature. There were hundreds of new photographs of the Fisk family in all its wholesomeness, walking into church, on the front porch, at the baseball park, the parents together, alone, dripping with love and affection. The first soft ads were still being edited, but Barry wanted to share them anyway. They had been filmed by a crew sent from Washington to Mississippi. The first was of Fisk standing by a Civil War monument at the Vicksburg battlefield, gazing off into the distance as if listening to distant cannons. His soft, richly accented voice played over. "I'm Ron Fisk. My great-great-grandfather was killed on this spot in July of 1863. He was a lawyer, a judge, and a member of the state legislature. His dream was to serve on the Supreme Court. That's my dream today. I am a seventh-generation Mississippian, and I ask for your support." Tony was surprised. "The Civil War?" "Oh, yes, they love it. What about the black vote?" "We'll get 30% of it from the churches. That's all we need." The next ad was shot in Ron's office. Jacket off, sleeves rolled up, desk arranged in a careful clutter. Looking sincerely at the camera, Ron talked about his love of the law, the pursuit of truth, the demands of fairness from those who sit on the bench. It was a fairly bland effort, but it did convey warmth and intelligence. There were a total of 6 ads. "Just the soft ones," Barry promised. A couple would not survive editing, and there was a good chance the camera crew would be sent back for more.
"What about the nasty ones?" Tony asked.
"Still in the writing stage. We won't need them until after Labor Day."
"How much have we spent so far?"
$250,000. A drop in the bucket.
They spent 2 hours with an internet consultant whose firm did nothing but raise money for political races. So far, he had put together an email bank with just over 40,000 names, individuals with a history of contributing, members of the associations and groups already on board, known political activists at the local level, and a smaller number of people outside of Mississippi who would feel sympathetic enough to send a check. He guessed that the list would grow by another 10,000, and he projected total contributions at somewhere in the range of $500,000. Most important, his list was ready and waiting. When given the green light, he simply pushed a button. The solicitation flew out, and the check started coming. The green light was the principal topic over a long dinner that night. The deadline to qualify was a month away. Though there were the usual rumors, Tony firmly believed that the race would attract no one else.
"There will be only 3 horses," he said,
and we own two of them.
What's McCarthy doing? Barry asked. He received daily updates on her movements, which so far had revealed little.
Not much. She appears to be shell-shocked. One day she's unopposed, the next she's got some crazy cowboy named Coley calling her a liberal convict lover, and the newspapers are printing everything he says. I'm sure she's getting advice from McElwain, her sidekick, but she has yet to put together a staff for the campaign.
Is she raising money?
The trial lawyers issued one of their standard panic emails last week, begging for money from the membership. I have no idea how that's going.
Sex?
Just the usual, boyfriend. You've got the report. No real dirt yet.
Shortly after opening the second bottle of a fine Oregon Pinot Noir, they decided to launch Fisk in 2 weeks. The boy was ready, straining at the leash, desperate to hit the trail. Everything was in place. He was taking a 6-month leave from his firm, and his partners were happy. And well, they should be. They had just picked up 5 new clients, 2 large timber companies, a pipeline contractor from Houston, and 2 natural gas firms. The vast coalition of lobbying groups was on board, ready with cash and foot soldiers. McCarthy was afraid of her shadow and apparently hoping Cleet Coley would simply go away or self-destruct. They touched glasses and toasted the eve of an exciting campaign. As always, the meeting was held in the fellowship hall of the Pine Grove Church. And as usual, several non-clients tried to wiggle their way in to hear the latest. They were politely escorted out by Pastor Ott, who explained that this was a very confidential meeting between the lawyers and their clients. Other than the Baker case, the Paytons had 30 Bowmore cases. 18 involved people who were already dead. The other 12 involved people with cancer in various stages. 4 years earlier, the Paytons had made the tactical decision to take their best case, Jeanette Baker's, and try it first. It would be far cheaper than trying all 31 at one time. Jeanette was the most sympathetic, having lost her entire family in the span of 8 months. That decision now looked brilliant. Wes and Mary Grace hated these meetings. A sadder, more tragic group of people could not be found anywhere. They had lost children, husbands, and wives. They were terminally ill and living with incredible pain. They asked questions that could not be answered, over and over, in slightly different variations, because no 2 cases were identical. Some wanted to quit, and others wanted to fight forever. Some wanted money, and others just wanted Crane to be held accountable. There were always tears and harsh words, and for this reason, Pastor Ott was there as a calming influence. Now, with the Baker verdict legendary, the Paytons knew the rest of their clients had much higher expectations. 6 months after the verdict, the clients were more anxious than ever. They called the office more often, they sent more letters and emails. The meeting had the extra tension caused by the funeral 3 days earlier of Leon Gatewood, a man they all despised. His body was found in a pile of brush 3 miles downriver from his capsized fishing boat. There was no evidence of foul play, but everyone suspected it. The sheriff was busy with an investigation. All 30 families were represented. The notepad Wes passed around had 62 names on it, names he knew well, including that of Frank Stone, a caustic bricklayer who usually said little during these meetings. It was assumed, without a shred of evidence, that if Leon Gatewood's death had been caused by someone else, then Frank Stone knew something about it. Mary Grace began with a warm hello. She thanked them for coming and for their patience. She talked about the Baker appeal, and for a little dramatic effect, she hoisted the thick brief filed by Crane's lawyers as evidence that many hours were being spent on the appellate front. All briefs would be in by September. Then the Supreme Court would decide how to handle the case. It had the option of passing it off to a lower court, the Court of Appeals, for an initial review, or it could simply keep it. A case of this magnitude would eventually be decided by the Supreme Court, and she and Wes were of the opinion that it would bypass the lower court. If that happened, oral arguments would be scheduled for later in the year, or perhaps early next year. Her best guess was a final ruling in about a year. If the court affirmed the verdict, there were several possible scenarios. Crane would be under enormous pressure to settle the remaining claims, which of course would be a highly favored result. If Crane refused to settle, she was of the opinion that Judge Harrison would consolidate the other cases and try them in one huge trial. In that event, their firm would have the resources to fight on. She confided in the clients that they had spent borrowed funds in excess of $400,000 to get the Baker case to a jury, and they simply could not do it again unless the first verdict was upheld. As poor as the clients were, they were not nearly as broke as their lawyers.
"What if the Baker verdict is rejected by the court?" asked Eileen Johnson.
Her head was bare from chemo, and she weighed less than 100 pounds. Her husband held her hand throughout the meeting.
"That's a possibility," Mary Grace admitted, "but we are confident it won't happen."
She said this with more assurance than she possessed. The Paytons felt good about the appeal, but any rational lawyer would be nervous.
"But if it happens, the court will send it back for another trial. It could be on all issues or simply on damages. It's hard to predict."
She moved on, anxious to get away from more talk about losing. She assured them that their cases were still receiving the full attention of their firm. Hundreds of documents were being processed each week and filed away. Other experts were being sought. They were in a holding pattern, but still working hard.
"What about this class action?" asked Curtis Knight, the father of a teenage boy who had died 4 years earlier.
The question seemed to arouse the crowd. Others less deserving were encroaching on their territory.
"Forget about it," she said. "Those plaintiffs are at the bottom of the pile. They win only if there's a settlement, and any settlement must first satisfy your claims. We control the settlement. You are not competing with those people."
Her answer seemed good enough. Wes took over with cautionary words. Because of the verdict, the pressure on Crane Chemical was greater than ever. They probably had investigators in the area watching the plaintiffs, trying to gather information that might be damaging.
"Be careful who you talk to. Be wary of strangers. Report anything even remotely unusual."
For a long-suffering people, this was not welcome news. They had enough to worry about. The questions continued and went on for over an hour. The Paytons worked hard to reassure, to show compassion and confidence, to give hope. But the tougher challenge was keeping a lid on expectations. If anyone in the room was concerned about a Supreme Court race, it was never mentioned. Chapter 20. When he stepped forward and gazed at the large congregation on Sunday morning, Ron Fisk had no idea how many pulpits he would visit over the next 6 months, nor did he realize that the pulpit would become a symbol of his campaign. He thanked his minister for the opportunity, then thanked his congregation, his fellow members of St. Luke's Baptist Church, for their indulgence. "Tomorrow, down the street at the Lincoln County Courthouse, I will announce my candidacy for the Mississippi Supreme Court. Doreen and I have been struggling with and praying about this for several months now. We have counseled with Pastor Rose. We have discussed it with our children, our families, and our friends, and we are finally at peace with our decision and want to share it with you before the announcement tomorrow." He glanced at his notes, looked a little nervous, then continued, "I have no background in politics. Frankly, I never had the stomach for it. Doreen and I have established a happy life here in Brookhaven, raising our kids, worshiping here with you, taking part in our community. We are blessed, and we thank God every day for His goodness. We thank God for this church and for friends like you. You are our family. Another nervous pause. I seek to serve on the Supreme Court because I cherish the values that we share. Values based on the Bible and our faith in Christ. The sanctity of the family, man and woman. The sanctity of life. The freedom to enjoy life without fear of crime and government intervention. Like you, I'm frustrated by the erosion of our values. They are under attack by our society, by our depraved culture, and by many of our politicians. Yes, also by our courts. I offer my candidacy as one man's fight against liberal judges. With your help, I can win. Thank you. Mercifully brief. Another long-winded sermon was surely coming next. Ron's words were so well received that a polite round of applause rippled through the sanctuary as he returned to his seat and sat with his family. 2 hours later, while the white churchgoers in Brookhaven were having lunch and the black ones were just getting cranked up, Ron bounded up red-carpeted steps to the massive podium of the Mount Pisgah Church of God in Christ on the west side of town and delivered a lengthier version of the morning's comments. He omitted the word liberal. Until 2 days earlier, he had never met the reverend of the town's largest black congregation. A friend pulled some strings and manipulated an invitation. That night, in the middle of a rowdy Pentecostal holy hour, he grabbed the pulpit, waited for the racket to die down, then introduced himself and made his appeal. He ignored his notes and spoke longer. He went after the liberals again. Driving home afterward, he was struck by how few people he actually knew in his small town. His clients were insurance companies, not people. He rarely ventured outside the security of his neighborhood, his church, his social circle. Frankly, he preferred to stay there. At 9 Monday morning, he gathered on the steps of the courthouse with Doreen and the kids, his law firm, a large group of friends, courthouse employees and regulars, and most of his Rotary Club, and he announced his candidacy to the rest of the state. It was not planned as a media event. Only a few reporters and cameras showed up. Barry Reinhart subscribed to the strategy of peaking on election day, not when the announcement is made. Ron delivered his carefully worded and rehearsed remarks for 15 minutes, with lots of applause thrown in. He answered every question the reporters had, then moved inside to a small, empty courtroom where he happily gave a 30-minute exclusive to one of the political reporters for the Jackson newspaper. The party then moved 3 blocks down the street, where Ron cut the ribbon across the door of his official campaign headquarters in an old building that had been freshly painted and covered with campaign propaganda. Over coffee and biscuits, he chatted with friends, posed for pictures, and sat for another interview, this one with a newspaper he'd never heard of. Tony Zachary was there, supervising the festivities and watching the clock. Simultaneously, a press release of his announcement was sent to every newspaper in the state and to the major dailies throughout the Southeast. One was also emailed to each member of the Supreme Court, each member of the legislature, every other elected official in the state, every registered lobbyist, thousands of state employees, every doctor with a license, and every lawyer admitted to the bar. There were 390,000 registered voters in the Southern District. Reinhart's internet consultants had found email addresses for about a fourth of them, and these lucky folks received the news online while Ron was still at the courthouse making his speech. A total of 120,000 emails went out in one blast. 42,000 solicitations for money were sent by email, along with a message that touted the virtues of Ron Fisk while attacking the social evils caused by liberal left-leaning judges who substitute their own agendas for those of the people. From a rented warehouse in South Jackson, a building Ron Fisk did not know about and would never lay eyes on, 390,000 stuffed envelopes were removed and taken to the central post office. Inside each was a campaign brochure with lots of endearing photos, a warm letter from Ron himself, a smaller envelope if one wished to send back a check, and a complimentary bumper sticker. The colors were red, white, and blue, and the artwork was obviously done by professionals. Every detail in the mailing was of the highest quality. At 11 a.m., Tony moved the show south to Macomb, the 11th largest city in the district. Brookhaven ranked 14th with a population of 10,800. Traveling in a newly leased Chevrolet Suburban with a volunteer named Guy at the wheel, with his new but already indispensable first assistant Monty in the front seat and on the phone, and with Doreen sitting by his side on the rather spacious middle bench of the SUV, Ron Fisk smiled smugly at the countryside flying by him. It was a moment to be savored. His first foray into politics, and in such grand style. All those supporters, their enthusiasm, the press and the cameras, the heady challenge of the job ahead, the thrill of winning, all in just the first 2 hours of the campaign. The strong rush of adrenaline was only a sample of what was coming. He imagined a great victory in November. He could see himself springing from the mundane anonymity of a small-town law practice to the prestige of the Supreme Court. It all lay before him. Tony followed closely behind, relaying a quick update to Barry Reinhardt. At the City Hall in Macomb, Ron announced again. The crowd was small but loud. There were a few friends, but the rest were total strangers. After two quick interviews with photos, he was driven to the Macomb airstrip, where he boarded a Lear 55, a handsome little jet built like a rocket, although, as Ron couldn't help but notice, much smaller than the G5 that had whisked him to Washington. Doreen barely managed to suppress her excitement at her first encounter with a private jet. Tony joined the flight. Guy raced ahead with the SUV. 15 minutes later, they landed in Hattiesburg, population 48,000, the third largest city in the district. At 1 p.m., Ron and Doreen were the guests at a prayer lunch thrown together by a loose coalition of fundamentalist pastors. The setting was an old Holiday Inn. Tony waited in the bar. Over badly fried chicken and butter beans, Ron did more listening than talking. Several of the preachers, evidently still inspired by their Sunday labors, felt the need to bless him with their views on various issues and evils. Hollywood, rap music, celebrity culture, rampant pornography, the internet, underage drinking, underage sex, and on and on. Ron nodded sincerely and was soon ready to escape. When he did say a few words, he chose all the right ones. He and Doreen had prayed about this race and felt the Lord's hand in it. Laws created by man should strive to emulate the laws of God. Only men of clear moral vision should judge the problems of others, and so on. He was unequivocally endorsed on the spot. Freed from the meeting, Ron addressed a group of 24 supporters outside the Forest County Circuit Court building. The event was covered by the Hattiesburg TV station. After a few questions, he walked along Main Street, shaking hands with any and all, passing out his slick brochures, and ducking into every law office for a quick hey howdy. At 3:30, the Lear 55 took off and headed to the coast. At 8,000 feet and climbing, it flew over the southwest corner of Cancer County. Guy was waiting with the Suburban at the Gulfport-Biloxi Regional Airport. Ron kissed Doreen goodbye, and the plane took her back to Macomb. Another driver there would take her to Brookhaven. At the Harrison County Courthouse, Ron announced again, answered the same questions, then sat down for a long interview with the Sun-Herald. Biloxi was the home of Sheila McCarthy. It was adjacent to Gulfport, the largest city in the Southern District, with a population of 65,000. Biloxi and Gulfport were the center of the coast region, a three-county area along the Gulf with 60% of the votes. To the east was Ocean Springs, Gautier, Moss Point, Pascagoula, and then Mobile. To the west was Passe Christiane, Long Beach, Waveland, Bay St. Louis, then New Orleans. Tony planned for Ron to spend at least half of his time there during the campaign. At 6 p.m., the candidate was introduced to his Coast office, a renovated fast food franchise on Highway 90, the heavily traveled four-lane at the beach. Brightly colored campaign signs blanketed the area around the headquarters, and a large crowd gathered to hear and meet their candidate. Ron knew none of them, nor did Tony. Virtually all were employees of some of the companies indirectly financing the campaign. Half worked in the regional office of a national auto insurance company. When Ron arrived and saw his headquarters, its decorations, and the crowd, he marveled at the organizational skills of Tony Zachary. This might be easier than he thought. The Gulf Coast's economy is now fueled by casinos, so he throttled back his high moral comments and dwelled on his conservative approach to judicial thought. He talked about himself, his family, his son Josh's undefeated Little League team, and for the first time, he voiced concern over the state's crime rate and its seeming indifference to executing condemned killers. Cleet Coley would have been proud. Dinner that night was a fancy fundraiser at the Biloxi Yacht Club, $1,000 a plate. The crowd was a mix of corporate suits, bankers, doctors, and insurance defense lawyers. Tony counted 84 present. Late that night, with Ron asleep in the room next door, Tony called Barry Reinhardt with a summary of the great day. It wasn't as colorful as Cleet's dramatic entrance, but it was far more productive. Their candidate had handled himself well. Day two began with a 7:30 prayer breakfast at a hotel in the shadows of the casinos. It was sponsored by a newly organized group known as the Brotherhood Coalition. Most of those in attendance were fundamentalist pastors from a dozen strains of Christianity. Ron was quickly learning the strategy of adapting to his audience, and he felt at home talking about his faith and how it would shape his decisions on the Supreme Court. He emphasized his long service to the Lord as a deacon and Sunday school teacher and almost choked up when he recalled the story of his son's baptism. Again, he was endorsed on the spot. At least half the state awoke to the morning newspapers with full-page ads for candidate Ron Fisk. The ad in Jackson's Clarion Ledger had a handsome photograph above the bold caption, "Judicial Reform." Smaller print gave Ron's pertinent biographical data, with emphasis on his membership in his church, civic organizations, and the American Rifle Association. Still smaller print listed an impressive collection of endorsements, family groups, conservative Christian activists, panels of ministers, and associations that seemed to represent the rest of humanity. Doctors, nurses, hospitals, dentists, nursing homes, pharmacists, retail merchants, real estate agents, banks, savings and loans, finance companies, brokerage firms, mortgage banks, insurance companies, health, life, medical, fire, casualty, malpractice, highway contractors, architects, energy companies, natural gas producers, and three legislative relations groups that represented the manufacturers of virtually every product to be found in any store. In other words, everyone who might get sued and therefore paid insurance premiums as protection. The list reeked of money and proclaimed that Ron Fisk, heretofore unknown, was now in the race as a serious player. The ad cost $12,000 in the Jackson Clarion Ledger, $9,000 in the Biloxi Sun-Herald, and $5,000 in the Hattiesburg American. The two-day cost of the Fisk rollout was roughly $450,000, which did not include travel expenses, the jet, and the internet assault. The bulk of the money was spent on direct mail. Ron spent the rest of Tuesday and Wednesday on the coast, with every minute planned with precision. Campaigns habitually run late, but not with Tony in charge. They announced at the courthouses in Jackson and Hancock counties, prayed with preachers, stopped at dozens of law offices, worked a few busy streets handing out brochures, and shook hands. Ron even kissed his first baby, and it was all recorded by a film crew. On Thursday, Ron made 6 more stops throughout South Mississippi, then hurried back to Brookhaven for a quick change of clothes. The game began at 6. Doreen was already there with the kids. The Raiders were warming up, and Josh was pitching. The team was in the dugout listening to an assistant when Coach Fisk hustled in and took charge. There was a nice crowd at the game. Ron already felt like a celebrity. Rather than researching law, Sheila's 2 clerks spent the day collecting press accounts of the Ron Fisk rollout. They gathered copies of the full-page ads from the different newspapers. They tracked the news online. As the file grew thicker, their moods sank. Sheila tried gamely to go about her job as if nothing was happening. The sky was falling, but she pretended to ignore it. Privately, and this usually meant a closed-door session with Big Mac, she was stunned and thoroughly overwhelmed. Fisk was spending what looked like $1 million, and she had raised virtually nothing. Cleet Coley had convinced her she had light opposition. The Fisk ambush was so brilliantly executed, she felt as though she had been killed in battle. The board of directors of the Mississippi Trial Advocates met in an emergency meeting late Thursday afternoon in Jackson. Its current president was Bobby Neal, a veteran trial lawyer with many verdicts under his belt and a long history of service to the MTA. 18 of the 20 directors were present, the highest number in many years. The board, by its very nature, was a collection of high-strung and highly opinionated lawyers who worked by their own rules. Few had ever had a boss. Most had clawed their way up through the lower rungs of the profession to reach a level of great respectability, at least in their opinions. To them, no calling was higher than that of representing the poor, the injured, the unwanted, the troubled. Typically, each gathering was long and loud and usually began with everyone present demanding the floor, and that was a normal meeting. Place the same group in an urgent setting with their backs pinned to the wall by the sudden and imminent threat of losing one of their most trusted allies on the Supreme Court, and all 18 began arguing at once. Each had all the answers. Barbara Mellinger and Skip Sanchez sat in one corner silent. No alcohol was being served. No caffeine. Only water. After a raucous half hour, Bobby Neal managed to bring the meeting into some semblance of order. He got their attention when he informed them that he had spent an hour with Justice McCarthy earlier in the day. "She is in great spirits," he said with a smile, one of the few around the table that afternoon. "She is hard at work doing her job and really doesn't want to get sidetracked. However, she understands politics and said more than once that she will run a hard campaign and has every intention of winning. I promised our unwavering support." He paused, shifted gears. "However, I found the meeting a bit discouraging. Cleet Coley announced 4 weeks ago, and Sheila still doesn't have a campaign manager. She has raised a few bucks, but she wouldn't say how much. I got the impression that she settled down after the Coley thing and convinced herself that he was simply a nut with no credibility. She thought she could slide. Her thoughts have now changed dramatically. She's been asleep, and now she's running to catch up. As we know from experience, there is very little money on our side of the street, except ours." "It'll take $1 million to beat this guy," someone said, and the comment was rapidly drowned out in a wave of ridicule. $1 million wasn't close. The tort reformers spent $2 million against Judge McElwain, and they lost by 3,000 votes. They'll spend more than that this time around, because they're better organized and really ticked off. And the guy who ran against McElwain was a reprobate who had never tried a lawsuit and had spent the last 10 years teaching political science at a junior college. This guy, Fisk, is a real lawyer. So they talked about Fisk for a while. at least 4 different conversations boiling at any given moment. Tapping his water glass, Bobby Neal slowly dragged them back to his agenda.
There are 20 of us on this board. If we commit $10,000 each right now, Sheila's campaign can at least get organized.
Instant silence. Deep breaths were taken. Water was gulped. Eyes darted here and there, searching for other eyes that might agree or disagree with this bold proposition.
Someone at the far end of the table barked, "That's ridiculous!"
The lights flickered. The AC vents went silent. Everyone gawked at Willie Benton, a fiery little Irish brawler from Biloxi. Benton rose slowly and spread his hands. They had heard his passionate summations before, and they settled in for another. Juries found him irresistible.
"Gentlemen and lady, this is the beginning of the end. We can't fool ourselves. The forces of evil who want to slam the courthouse doors and deny our clients their rights, the same pro-business lobby that has slowly, methodically marched across this country and purchased one Supreme Court seat after another, that same bunch of assholes is here, banging on our door. You saw their names in those ads, Fisk ran. It's a confederation of dunces, but they have the money. We have what I believe is a consistent one-vote majority on the Supreme Court, and here we sit, the only group who can fight these thugs, and we argue about how much we should give. I'll tell you what we should give. Everything. Because if we don't, then the practice of law as we know it will quickly fade away. We won't take cases anymore, because we won't be able to win them. The next generation of trial lawyers will not exist. I gave $100,000 to Judge McElwain, and it was a stretch. I'll do the same for Judge McCarthy. I don't have an airplane. I don't handle the mass torts and rake in outrageous fees. Y'all know me. I'm from the old school. One case at a time, one trial after another. But I'll sacrifice again. So should you. We all have our toys. If you can't pledge $50,000 each, then get off this board and go home. You know you can afford it. Sell a condo, a car, a boat, skip a couple of vacations, hock your wife's diamonds. You pay your secretaries $50,000 a year. Sheila McCarthy is far more important than any secretary or any associate. The limit is $5,000 per person, Willie, someone said.
Well, aren't you a smart son of a bitch, he fired back. I have a wife and 4 children. That's $30,000 right there. I also have 2 secretaries and some satisfied clients. I'll raise $100,000 by the end of the week, and everyone here can do the same.
He sat down, his face red. After a long pause, Bobby Neal looked at Barbara Mellinger and asked, "How much did we give Judge McElwain?"
1.2 from about 300 trial lawyers.
How much did he raise?
1.4.
How much would you guess McCarthy will need to win?
It was a subject Barbara and Skip Sanchez had discussed for 3 days.
$2 million,
she said without hesitation. Bobby Neal frowned and recalled the fundraising efforts 2 years earlier on behalf of Jimmy McElwain. Pulling teeth without anesthesia would have been easier.
Then we have to raise $2 million, he said with confidence.
They nodded gravely and seemed to agree on that figure. They returned to the challenge on the table, and a fierce debate erupted about how much each should commit. The ones who earned a lot also spent a lot. Those who were struggling were afraid to commit. One admitted he had lost his last 3 jury trials and was effectively broke at the moment. Another, a mass tort star with his own jet, promised $150,000. They adjourned without agreeing on a fixed amount, which surprised no one. Chapter 21. The qualifying deadline passed with no other fireworks. Justice Callaghan from the Central District and Justice Bateman from the Northern escaped opposition and were safe for another 8 years. Both had a history of showing little sympathy for accident victims, consumers, and criminal defendants, and thus were greatly admired by the business community. At the local level, only two of the state circuit court judges drew opposition. One, though, was Judge Thomas Alsobrook Harrison IV. An hour before the deadline passed, a Hattiesburg real estate lawyer named Joy Hoover filed the necessary papers and fired a few shots in a press release. She was a local political activist, well-regarded, and well-known in the county. Her husband was a popular pediatrician who operated a free clinic for poor mothers as a hobby. Hoover was recruited by Tony Zachary and Judicial Vision. She was a gift from Barry Reinhart to Carl Trudeau, who on several occasions in quiet conversations with Reinhart had voiced his strong feelings against the judge who presided over the Baker trial. That judge now had his hands full and would be unable to meddle, as he was prone to do, in other races. For a mere $100,000, the legitimate above-the-table commitment to Hoover, Judge Harrison now had much more serious matters on his hands. Reinhart was scheming on several fronts. He picked a quiet day in late June to fire his next salvo. Two gay men, Al Meyercheck and Billy Spano, had quietly arrived in Jackson 3 months earlier. They rented a small apartment near Millsaps College, registered to vote, and obtained Mississippi driver's licenses. Their old ones were from Illinois. They claimed to be self-employed illustrators who worked at home. They kept to themselves and met no one. On June 24th, they walked into the offices of the Hinds County Circuit Clerk and requested the necessary forms to apply for a license to be married. The clerk balked and attempted to explain that the laws under which she operated did not allow same-sex marriages. Things grew tense. Heated words were offered by Meyercheck and Spano, and they finally left. They called a reporter from the Clarion Ledger and gave their side of the story. The following day, with the reporter and a photographer, they returned to the clerk's office and again requested the paperwork. When it was denied, they began shouting and threatening to sue. The next day, the story was front-page news, complete with a photograph of the two men as they berated the hapless clerk. They retained a radical lawyer, paid him $10,000, and made good on their pledge to litigate the matter. The new lawsuit also made the front page. It was shocking news. Stories of attempts by gay people to legally marry were common in places like New York, Massachusetts, and California, but were unheard of in Mississippi. What was the world coming?